from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. And today on The Breakdown, it has been a busy few weeks in our nation's capital. Just 1 week after a pro-Trump mob attacked the U.S. Capitol, the House impeached President Trump for a second time. This all comes 1 week, of course, before Joe Biden is set to take the oath of office.
Lots going on as Democrats prepare to take control of the White House and both houses of Congress. We'll be joined by a woman who knows firsthand the difference between being in the majority and the minority, former California Senator Barbara Boxer, will talk with us about the week's events and what comes next.
Barbara Boxer was elected to the U.S. Senate, of course, in 1992, the so-called Year of the Woman.
Women only got a year, you know.
I know.
Men, the rest of the years were the Year of the Man, I guess.
This is something to discuss with the senator, I think. You know, she was elected the same time that voters sent Dianne Feinstein to the Senate. And Senator Boxer retired in 2016. She was replaced, of course, by Kamala Harris, who we all know is now going to be the Vice President of the United States as of next week. Senator exactly. Barbara Boxer, welcome to Political Breakdown.
Good to have you.
Well, it's fun to be with you.
Good, good, good. Well, we want to talk about impeachment, but before we do that, you know, obviously we were all stunned and shocked, if not surprised, by what happened last week at the Capitol. And as someone who worked in that building for so many years, what was going through your mind as you watched that unfold?
Scott, as I watched that unfold, it was really like nothing I ever felt before. I would say to everyone listening, if you're in the sanctuary of your home and there's a home invasion of a big group of people and they start destroying everything you love, that Capitol for me, I worked there for, you know, 34 years, 10 years in the House and 24 years in the United States Senate. And I have to say, after 9/11, a lot of security was put in place. And I thought, oh, my goodness, they're making it a fortress. And I could tell you, as I watched those insurrectionists run up the steps of the Senate, those precious steps that I could not, after 9/11, take you up there to get onto the Senate floor, because the sharpshooters would say, get down. You could only go like 2-3 steps, and they say, get down. That's how the security was. And as I watched, I thought, how could this happen? How could this be? And I think those are questions that are going to be answered over the next few months and weeks, because I do not understand it. And just so you know, if a United States senator or a House member walked in to try to get to the floor of where they work, the floor of the House, the floor of the Senate, the guards had to make sure it was you. Show me your PIN. Are you sure you're not, you know, are you sure you're a member? And yet, all this happened before my eyes, and the smashing of those windows and watching them take things that were symbols of our country. I know I'm going on and on, but it was emotional point that it was almost an out-of-body experience. And my friends were calling me, and I said, I can't talk. I don't want to talk today. Mm-hmm. You know, it's horrible. It's a violation of our democracy and of our freedom and of our country.
I just want to ask, you know, in terms of there will be, of course, an investigation, a very thorough, multiple probably investigations. And one of the things that stuck out for me is how some of the members, the Democrats, and especially ones with security or military backgrounds, are saying something weird was happening the day before, that there seemed to be people in the Capitol going through large groups, and you know, they want to know what, why were they guests of those members of Congress? What do you make of that?
Well, it's very suspicious. I can't say, you know, what happened, because obviously I don't know. I only know what you know. But I'm saying to you that they have photos, they know from video cameras who was taking these people on a quote-unquote tour of the Capitol. I want you to know, I spoke to a couple of my friends in the United States Senate, and one of them told me he was in his office in the Capitol, you know, waiting for a vote because it was right near the floor, and that's where a lot of us would go, especially, I would say, in COVID. They don't want to all be in the room at the same time. And he was with his spouse, and the... it's hard to even tell you the story. The insurrectionists looked through the window from the outside and saw they were in the room, and they found their way to this room, which is very hard to find, in the Capitol's office, and started banging on the door and banging on the door. He said it felt like an hour, but he doesn't know, you know, he lost track of time, and yelling, "Kill the infidels."
Wow.
And banging and banging, and I they were rescued eventually. But had those people gotten in there, I don't know what would have happened. And I spoke to another senator who said he was on the floor of the Senate, was whisked away, but somebody found his office in the Capitol and destroyed it and took, he had a picture of himself with the Dalai Lama, and they took all kinds of things like that. And Lord knows what they're going to do with this stuff. This is, I'm telling you these stories, which I don't think have been told yet, to just give everyone an idea of just how dangerous. And the last point I make is that I just saw a young man who got elected to Congress, a Republican, who voted for impeachment, which is very brave to do, might I say, if you're a Republican. It's the right thing and a brave thing.
That's the guy from Michigan, right?
Yeah.
But this particular man said that he's having to wear, you know, body armor. He's asked to please give him body armor because they're very afraid they're going to be killed.
Well, can I ask you too? Yeah, it's really remarkable, I think, given what you spelled out too. I mean, having covered Capitals for my entire career, you know, you're always thinking about, am I acting properly? Am I going to get kicked out by the sergeant at arms? Like, how, you know, and but. Part of, I think, what is especially potentially really scary about this isn't just, you know, the idea of maybe people giving tours where they were, you know, doing this recon, but you also have members tweeting out Nancy Pelosi's location. You have, you know, you have people who are followers of this QAnon conspiracy there. I'm just wondering, like, how you think people in Congress are dealing with that, given it, I mean, it just feels like it must be so different than it was when you were there even just a few short years ago.
Yes. Well, as I say, I've been talking to colleagues. I've never heard fear in their voices before. And we've had a lot of things, believe me. And I was there after 9/11 when we thought a plane was coming to the Capitol. So, I mean, I've seen a lot. But this is from within. And there's nothing as disturbing, shocking, and worrisome as, you know, terrorists that are homegrown. That's what we have. And that's why it is critical to have this investigation, find out exactly what happened, and get our country to a place where there's no fear. And we have to deal with it. And that we will.
Yeah. Take us back, if you would, to that day, September 11th, 2001, that terrifying day when you and your, as you said, you and your colleagues were hustled out of that building. And in the middle of that terror, there was a funny anecdote which you've told afterwards about your shoes. Can you just recount that for us?
Sure, I will. Yes, I'll never forget it. I was in the Capitol building at the leader's office. The leader then was Tom Daschle. We were just going over the budget and Medicare and Social Security. I'll never forget it. There was a little camera, not a camera, a little TV, you know, one of those little ones just right on the wall. And out of the corner of someone's eye, they said, "Wait a minute, a pilot must have had a heart attack. Look at what happened." And we saw the World Trade Center. And I kept saying, "This is crazy." And they, "Let's get back to work. We'll keep our eye on it, but let's get back to work." And we started talking. All of a sudden, out the window, we saw the flames from the Pentagon. And immediately came in the Capitol Police, that everyone now knows, the Capitol Police, and they said, "We have to get you all out of here. Get out of here." And they grabbed the leader and his assistant, Harry Reid, and it was Tom Daschle and Harry, and they sent them to an undisclosed location. And the rest of us, they said, just get out and go back to your office. Get away from the Capitol. So Jay Rockefeller, who looked to me to be 7 foot six, he must have been a seven.
You know, he's 6'7", I think, yeah.
Yeah, right. And I'm like barely 5 feet tall. And he grabs my arm and he says, take off those high heels. We're going. And I said, no terrorist is going to make me take off my high heels. And I kept up with him and we ran down the steps and the rest is history of what happened. And then that night we were in a safe location and we all decided we need to go back to the Capitol and stand right in front of it. And we sang the Star Spangled Banner and everybody together. Well, that was a threat from without. This is a threat from within. Mm-hmm. And it is a different, more terrifying threat in a way. You know, we're able to harden, you know, our airports and do all the things we did is so difficult. Not that the threat is over forever, but we dealt with it. This is harder to deal with. So the first thing you have to do is get to the bottom of it.
Yeah. All right, Senator, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll have more of our conversation with former California Senator Barbara Boxer. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
I'm Jonquilin Hill, host of The Weeds, and I know that politics can feel like a joke. And not always in the ha-ha funny way. On The Weeds, we try to split the difference.
When you think run out of money, you think that we're going to get to a point where, like, one guy retires and Social Security is like, sorry, y'all, got to board up.
Like that's it. Sorry, he got the last check.
I always call him Jim. Like, Jim got it. Sorry, y'all. He got the last check, and that's all the checks we got, and Social Security is no more.
Check out The Weeds every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Think the case for global decline has been oversold? Then you should check out the latest season of What Could Go Right. It's co-hosted by me, Emma Varvalugas, and Progress Network founder Zachary Carabel. What Could Go Right may not have all the answers, but it asks the key questions. Every week, we discuss the world's most pressing issues without resorting to pessimism or sensationalism. We talk with guests like NPR anchor Steve Inskeep, democracy expert Yasha Munk, prolific writer and historian Rebecca Solnit, and green energy entrepreneur Jigar Shah. So go ahead, listen to What Could Go Right on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer here with Marisa Lagos. We're talking with former California Senator Barbara Boxer. And Senator, I'm sure you were watching yesterday, at least part of the impeachment vote in the House. And unlike either the impeachment of Bill Clinton or the first impeachment of Donald Trump, there were 10 Republicans, 10 members of the president's party who did vote for impeachment at, 10 more than voted last time. What do you make of that? And did you see courage in those votes?
I definitely see courage in any Republican who stands up to Donald Trump. And I mean by that political courage, I actually want to add physical courage at this point in time. And yes, this is the only president to be impeached twice. He will go down in history in that way. And there were the most votes for impeachment than were ever cast, you know, against any other president. So it's very sobering, and yes, I feel the people who did this were brave, and in many ways, I appreciate that.
Senator, I'm curious. I mean, there's a lot of conversation happening now about how to handle the Senate trial. Obviously, Joe Biden doesn't want his entire first 100 days, you know, made up of that. But I also think having watched Washington as long as you and we have, it seems like, you know, if this could really fade away if they don't tackle it. I mean, what do you think the best way forward is for Democrats right now?
Well, I think the way the Clinton impeachment was handled is kind of a way to go. And how was that? We decided we had to do the business of governance, and yet we didn't want this to linger. So as somebody said, you got to walk and chew gum at the same time. You can do, 6 hours of of the business at hand, meaning getting the votes on Joe's team in place and whatever emergency legislation that he wants to get through and Congress agrees. And then you can turn to the impeachment at the end of the day and put several hours in on that. So I don't know what they're going to do. I'm not saying this is what is going to happen, but if I were to guess at what would happen, that's what I think Chuck Schumer will do. Now, Chuck Schumer had asked Mitch McConnell to bring back the Senate this very week and deal with this before the 20th, and Mitch McConnell refused to do that. So now it lands in Chuck's lap. So I do think that's what they may well do. Or they may do 3 days of work on all of President Biden's list that he needs to do, and save 2 days or 1 day for the impeachment. You know, this impeachment trial is a pretty, it's only one article, right? And it, they've got some amazing lawyers as House managers, and they're constitutional experts. They're experts in free speech and civil rights and in criminal law. So they'll be able to present that pretty easily, and I think it could, they could get done with it in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. You, we mentioned at the top, got elected along with Dianne Feinstein in 1992. It was the year of the woman, on the heels of the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings, where, as you recall, Joe Biden, who was the chair of the Judiciary Committee, got a lot of criticism from women. And, you know, some of that criticism came back during the campaign, and you really stood by him. But I'm wondering, you know, as someone who has been such a strong advocate for women in your career, what do you think Joe Biden learned from those Clarence Thomas hearings and the aftermath?
Well, he's learned a tremendous amount in the years that he was vice president and after that. And, you know, hearing from people who basically said that he was trying to, in his own words, really protect Anita Hill by saying, let's not call any more witnesses. You know, he was concerned about how it would turn. But, you know, I think he sees, a lot of us felt he should have allowed witnesses to corroborate some of the things that she had said. And so he understood that. But he's really tried to dedicate himself to helping women in ways through charity and other ways of helping, you know, give women education. And he's certainly shown that he has a huge number of terrifically qualified women in his organization right now. So I think rather than dwell on the mistakes of the past, I know he spoke to Anita Hill about all this, and it's not that they're going to always agree on everything, but he confronted it. You know, now he has a chance to do so much for women, for men, for children, for family, for the middle class, to get us out of this pandemic and get this economy moving and deal with this, you know, domestic terrorism. He's got so much on his plate.
Yeah.
I was thinking it's even more than FDR, you know, in the depths of the Depression. This is unbelievable. And we have to fix things. We just have to get them done.
Well, I want to ask you about one policy area. I feel like we're obviously spending so much time right now thinking about Trump and the end of his, you know, presidency, but also COVID. And hopefully that is not going to be a long-term problem. One sort of existential threat, though, that you've worked on is climate change. And I'm just curious what you think needs to happen and how much of a priority the Biden administration can make that. Because that, I mean, I know you've said that that has been one of your biggest regrets, is that you didn't, weren't able to pass some of those bills.
Oh, yes. Do I have so many regrets. We came within six votes of reaching 60 to have put in place, putting a price on carbon, which is the only way, I shouldn't say the only way, but the best way to move toward clean energy. And once we do that, we create so many jobs and clean up the air and, you know, everybody wins on it. But let me tell you the great news. Number one, President-elect Biden has said very clearly that climate change is, you know, right at the top of his priorities after this pandemic. And he sees this as a way to really create good paying, great jobs right here in America. And it is such a win-win, because moving to clean energy, that means putting solar rooftops on houses. You know, you can't contract that out to anybody else. It's got to be done right here. And, you know, clean cars. And taking the lead on these things means that we will have the technology and the products that we can get around, you know, the world. And that helps us as well. I'm just going to finish here. I think Joe sees climate change as a threat, but he sees it as a huge opportunity to create really good jobs and get this carbon out of the air so that we don't have a planet that's uninhabitable.
If you're just joining us, I'm Scott Schaefer here with Marisa Lagos. You're listening to Political Breakdown, and our guest today is former California Senator Barbara Boxer. And Senator, you know a little something about being a senator in a closely divided Senate. It was, I think, 50-50 after the 2000 elections. George W. Bush gets elected, and then I think Vermont Senator Jim Jeffords actually left the GOP, so that gave the Democrats a slight edge. But what advice do you have for incoming Vice President Kamala Harris? I'm wondering, have you talked with her about what it's like to, you know, preside over a Senate that is just split right down the middle?
I have not spoken to her in a very long time, but I could tell you she is serving with Joe Biden, who is a master of the Senate. He spent so many years there, and when he was vice president, he sat in that chair that she'll sit in. So I think she's got the most incredible mentor. She also has a great advantage from any other vice president who would not come from the Senate, because she knows the Senate. She knows the players. She knows how it all works. So, I mean, I honestly think she's extremely well prepared, perhaps one of the best prepared vice presidents to sit in that seat as president of the Senate. But I could tell you, in those days when we had 50-50, I remember it. The good news was that Tom Daschle and Trent Lott, who were the leaders of the both parties, then got along really well. And so they were able to function in a very, very fair way. And they did. And that helped in terms of what numbers we're going to have in the committees, and how is it going to run, and how are we going to decide what comes up before the body. So, you know, I'm hopeful. I'm not holding my breath. I'm hopeful that Mitch McConnell will become a little bit more of a, shall we say, work for country rather than party, and see us, you know, be able to replicate that sense of camaraderie that we had. There's a lot of people in the Senate now who are on the Republican side who are so far to the right that I don't know that we get them, but I think there's enough to make a difference. And I can tell you, one of the great things about Joe Biden is that he knows how to bring people together more than anybody else.
Yeah. Senator, I mean, you're talking about camaraderie and bipartisanship, but at the same time, Dianne Feinstein, you served with for many years, has really been attacked as being too bipartisan. You know, there was so much concern after the hearings of the last Supreme Court justice that she was sort of too close to Lindsey Graham. There's been questions about her age and ability to do the job. I mean, what do you think of all of these attacks, and do you think it's time for her to step down?
Well, I'm just not going to go into that. I made history with Dianne Feinstein, and let me tell you, we did a lot of good things together. So I think you'd have to ask her the questions that you're asking me.
We'd love to, but she won't talk to us about it.
Maybe that's why.
Let me ask you about Kamala Harris. I have to say, I was a little surprised. We're all texting each other here as we're talking. I was a little surprised when you said, I haven't talked to Kamala Harris in a long time. Is there anything to make of that? I mean, I know that she and Senator Feinstein were not particularly close.
I worked really hard for them, and, you know, I'm here if she needs me, of course. I'm not the type of person, you know the type of person is, you haven't called, you haven't visited, you know. I know what she's going through. Imagine what she's going through. And, you know, if she feels she needs my input, I am right here. And she knows that.
All right. I do want to ask you about something that was in the news last week. You, the Biden inaugural committee returned you $500. You donated after reports that you were registered as a foreign agent for a Chinese firm that's actually been accused of helping the government imprison Uyghur Muslims in concentration camps. So you decided to drop them as a client after this. And you said that it's my continued involvement has become a negative distraction for the effort. To me, that sounds like a political answer. I'm curious about the ethics. You've been such an advocate for, you know, your whole career. Why take on a client like that to begin with?
Well, I haven't. It took me less than 24 hours to drop that client. I don't know if you saw that, and I've deregistered, so I don't have that client. But let me put it in from my perspective and why I considered it.
Mm-hmm.
So I had registered to consult for this Chinese camera firm. They have business and jobs in America since 2006. And they really needed guidance on living up to the spirit and letter of American human rights laws. And that was my intent. But the fact that I did have this association made it sound like I was hurting human rights. Like, that's the way you asked. And I'm trying to do the opposite. So I realized I made a mistake. I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
So immediately stepped up and said the three words no politician or former politician or no reporter ever wants to make. I was wrong.
Yeah. I mean, that's, do you feel, is this an inherent challenge of becoming a lobbyist after you've been in a position of power?
Well, the truth is, I wasn't signed on for a lobbyist. I was signed on as a strategist, and that's very different. I don't ever lobby any colleagues, and that's a difference.
Yeah.
But no, I haven't had this problem. I've had a wonderful several years. I've been working. I taught at USC at the Center for the Political Future, and now I advise them. And I've done consulting work mostly in healthcare and the environment, and I'm doing some media work, so not
you talk to us. You return our calls.
Charitable.
Yes, we appreciate your calling us back all the time. Hey, Liz, we're short on time, but I want to ask you. I know you live in Rancho Mirage, and I'm told you live in the same gated community that Spiro Agnew retired in. What is it about these Democrats? They all want to live like Republicans when they retire.
Well, if you knew this community, you wouldn't see the ghost of Spiro Agnew. It's quite different. Now, it's a very diverse, wonderful spot, and I love it. But the reason I wanted to be down here is because it's so peaceful. And, you know, after my hectic years of life, I thought this would be a good thing. But you also have a tiny little 800-square-foot place in Oakland. We love that, too.
Are you taking up golf, or what are you doing down
there? Yeah, what's...
Well, let's just say what I do to stay healthy is do a lot of walking. That's what I do most. You know, I try to really walk every day, 2 to 3 miles, and that's important. And, you know, I usually can get it done. And that's what I like to do. You know, in this time of COVID, it's really hard to get up and go. But at least in this beautiful climate, I can walk around the community. It's good.
All nice right. Break from the news.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Senator Boucher, thank you so much.
Not that I don't listen. I listen to the news while I'm walking, to be honest.
Oh, yeah. It's hard. That's what podcasts are for. Senator, thank you so much. Stay well, and all the best to you in 2021.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
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 That's it for today's Political Breakdown. It's a production of KQED Public Radio.
Our producer is Guy Marzorati. Our engineer is Katie McMurrin. KQED's team also includes Holly Kernan, Ethan Tovin-Lindsay, Vinny Tong, Erica Aguilar, and Jonathan Blakely. I'm Marisa Lagos. You can find me on Twitter at @mlagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm @ScottSchaefer. Thanks so much for listening. Stay safe.
Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.